So, Dr. Ginn, I tell you what, this is this whole issue of who ends up on the Supreme Court, as my mother used to say, is more than a notion. And it can be pretty complicated. As you mentioned, we have had situations where politicians definitely want, despite what they claim, justices who will reflect their ideology. Of course, these politicians, the representatives, the senators are talking with the presidents, and the presidents, of course, want someone who will most usually want someone who will reflect their ideology. And even though we have a lot of we amongst people who are amongst we the people who also claim, I don't want a political ideologue. I want someone who's just going to accurately interpret the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And we come up with all these beautiful ways of saying we don't want it to be a partisan decision. And as it turns out, there's just no question that for the politicians, whether they be the presidents, the representatives, or the senators, they want political ideologues. What about those of us who are amongst we the people? Are we being sincere when we say we don't want political ideologues?
I would say we might think we're being sincere, but in reality, I think we all have our preferences on how we want the court to rule on certain issue areas. So, you know, if we are wanting to make sure certain precedents stand, so say, you know, Roe v. Wade, then obviously we may say we want a non-ideologue, but we want someone who leans more conservatively, who is going to perhaps revisit or restrict that precedent of Roe v. Wade. So I think it's one of those things where we say we want one thing, but really what we want is that we want someone to get to the decision that we would have made, mm-hmm. and then we're going to say that that's being nonpartisan, but really it isn't at all.
It's so interesting. I hear people say, I want someone who would just accurately interpret the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, I mean, whether a person accurately or inaccurately interprets the Constitution, with so many people from amongst we the people who don't even read the Constitution,
right.
much less try to understand it, how would they even know whether a justice is accurately or inaccurately interpreting the Constitution? And they're saying that's what they use as their litmus test.
Right. And then you get into the idea of, okay, well, is the Constitution, when you want someone who's just going to accurately or inaccurately read the Constitution, are you saying someone like Gorsuch, who's the current nominee, who's going to treat it much like Scalia would in that, you know, original intent, or, you know, if it's not in there, it's not a protection, et cetera? Or do you want someone who's going to look at it as this living and breathing document that, you know, expands and the meanings of rights expands as our, you know, challenges before us or our lifestyle changes? And so, you know, both individuals on both sides of the political spectrum can make that argument, but what they have in mind for how they would want someone to even interpret the Constitution, they can line it up very easily with their own ideology while still saying, you know, I'm in favor of someone who's just going to uphold the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. So, you bring up this point that is, I think, so critical. Is the Constitution basically set in stone, or is it a living and breathing document? How do we determine what the framers of the Constitution had in mind? Did they want it to be living and breathing? Did they want it to be set in stone? Or do we even have any ways of knowing the answer to that question?
And see, and that's where, you know, you get back to this idea of, you know, it's the document wrought out of political compromise, right? And this whole idea of it, part of the way it was passed is because some of the words meant different things to different people. And so you pass it, and then you think, how do you know what they intended? You go back and you say, what did the framers intend? Well, it depends on which framer you're talking about. So like if you go back to Thomas Jefferson, he was a big, states' rights not have a large centralized government. He believed that, every 27 years the people ought to come together for a new constitutional convention. So the dead were not binding the living, right? So if you want to go with him as your constitutional framer or your, founding father, you're going to get a much different view than, say, if you went with John Adams. Right. So the problem is you're really just kicking the ideological tension back several centuries, but you're never going to get to the true issue of, what is it supposed to mean and what was it meant to protect? And do you take it as, well, once we decide it does protect this, is that what we're going to move forward and accept? And that's going to be the interpretation from here on out. Well, that works well if everyone agrees on it, right? But if everyone doesn't, or say something was wrongly decided, then that needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. So, if you want to say, what does the Equal Protection Clause mean? Well, what it meant under, Plessy versus Ferguson was wrong. Then we got it right with Brown versus the Board of Education. I think most people will agree with that. If you go to, say, the right to privacy and whether it exists or not, a majority of people today may say, yes, it does, although it clearly doesn't, right? In the Constitution, it isn't there. But the people will, in general, say, yes, I do have this right to privacy, protections from government intrusions. But then when you say, well, that also includes the right to have an abortion, then you're fragmenting that further. And so it's just really the ideological issue never escapes this problem.
Because
that's why the appointment of a Supreme Court justice is so important, because they do make these decisions that then tell us what the Constitution means that then have real-world implications for us. And one of the things that, we don't talk about often, but we ought to contemplate, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but we need to contemplate that you have these individuals who we know have an ideological slant, who are appointed to make these decisions for life. And so if they make a decision and they get it wrong, or they're out of touch with, what the American people want, there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, you can impeach and remove a Supreme Court justice for, treason or high crimes and misdemeanors, et cetera. I mean, they're subject to the impeachment clause, but you can't remove them like you can your senator, mm-hmm. right, or your president. If you don't like what they do, then what do? You
vote them out.
Choose someone else.
Yeah.
But you can't do that with the Supreme Court. And when you have so many things that are decided 5-4, then it's obvious that ideology played a role. And it just happens to be who has the majority at any given time.
And it's so interesting you mentioned that. When President Obama nominated Merrick Garland,
mm-hmm.
he picked someone who would be palatable to both sides of the aisle. And still the Republicans in... I think really just a show of ugliness, made it very clear there was going to be no phase of the process put mm-hmm. into play. They weren't going to talk with the man. They were not going to hold any hearings, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And for all practical purposes, as far as the political process goes, it seems like they got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions. Number one, is our Congress indeed obligated by the Constitution to act on a judicial nomination? And number two, related to that, what are the possible pros and cons for the Democrats if they were to drag this process out as long as possible? You mentioned that this is something that they could do through the filibuster, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Do they stand to pay, for example, at the next midterm election? Or, how can they play this out so that it seems like they're taking a stand, but they're taking a position that America, quote unquote, will find acceptable?
Yeah, but to your first question, I think that the Republicans were obligated to act on the Garland nomination. I think waiting, 11 months, to and blatantly saying we're not going to do anything. Were they obligated to confirm him? Absolutely not. They should have held hearings. They should have had a vote on him. And then if he wasn't confirmed, they could have said he didn't have the votes, right? By doing that, I think that they did open themselves up to the Democrats being able to now, you know, have turnabout is fair play, and that they can drag it out as long as possible. I do think, you know, given that Leader McConnell decided, you know, we're not going to even act on this, I don't think he'll have any qualms with going with the nuclear option. It's just a matter of whether everyone else in the Senate and his party will go for that as well. So that could always fail. I don't think it would, but it could fail. The problem with doing that, and this is what we were talking about earlier, the Gorsuch nomination is for Scalia's seat, and Gorsuch is very similar to Scalia and will just sort of return the court to the status quo. The next nomination, which there's likely to be another one during the Trump administration, right, because you've got three justices who are either at 80 or over 80 years old, some of them in better health than others, but they're Breyer, Ginsburg, and Kennedy. Kennedy is a more conservative justice, but he's also the swing vote on many social issues. So any one of those three, if they decide to retire or, you know, have failing health issues, et cetera, and President Trump gets to nominate someone there, that's going to dramatically shift the balance of the court, because you're going to have a more moderate replaced by a more conservative. You're going to solidify a conservative majority on the court. And if the Democrats fight this nomination hard and allow the Republicans to use the nuclear option to no longer have the filibuster, then they will have no leg to stand on to fight a more conservative justice nomination under President Trump.
Say that again. Make that final point again.
Okay. If they allow the Republicans to use the nuclear option where you no longer have the filibuster, mm-hmm. what will happen when President Trump gets to nominate another justice, particularly if it happens within this term of Congress where the Republicans have 52 senators, the Democrats will have no recourse to block that nomination at all.
You
and
said
it will dramatically change the composition of the court. And so, unlike other times where, and again, going back to the Garlic nomination, President Obama knew that that nomination was going to be difficult. So he chose a nominee that, while they were more liberal, they were moderate, because he was trying to say, if I get this nominee to the Senate, I might be able to, you know, pull some Republicans over mm-hmm. to my side. He will look at this and say, it could have been worse, right? It could have been someone much more extreme. To some extent, Gorsuch isn't nearly as conservative as people want to paint him. He is tried and true conservative, but President Trump could have actually chosen someone much more conservative, much less qualified, much more ideological, all kinds of much more things. The next nomination, if there's no filibuster, there's nothing to stop him from doing that. There's nothing to stop him from nominating someone who is blatantly ideological.
And so with this Gorsuch nomination, for the Democrats to try to position things in a way that will be favorable from their perspective, for the next nomination, they need to make sure that they're filibustering this nomination. And then you said that if the Republicans go for the nuclear option and the Democrats allow that nuclear option to take place, then they won't have a leg to stand on when President Trump gets ready to make his next nomination. I want to ask you this. Is there anything that the Democrats can do to block the nuclear option?
Well, what I was saying is that I don't think they should filibuster this particular nomination.
I
think
you.
They should wait until the next nomination. And by doing that, they preserve the filibuster. They're basically saying, we're not going to use it now because there's no, I mean, we don't agree with everything Gorsuch says and everything that he stands for, but in general, he's qualified and you know, you won the election, you get to pick your person. When the next time, when, say, Ginsburg retires and they're going to be nominating someone else, this is where they say, you know, this person, we can't let them go to the court, et cetera, et cetera. And then they've developed credibility by saying, you know, we let Gorsuch get confirmed. This person is a bridge too far, et cetera.
So the way this works then, with regards to the filibuster, the minority party can filibuster just about any issue they want to, even if that means they filibuster 30 or 40 different issues in a term. But if the nuclear option goes into play, is the nuclear option automatically in play for the rest of that term, or does the majority party have to enact that nuclear option each time they're trying to overcome a filibuster?
The nuclear option that they used for lower-level judges and cabinet appointments was a complete rewriting of Senate rules. So right now, there is no longer the filibuster for lower court judicial nominees or cabinet picks. And as we talked about, that was relevant in the Trump administration because there were several ones that I'm certain the Republicans would have filibustered if there would have been that option. So if they use it here, then they would rewrite the rules and it would be in, you know, in the next administration if, say, a Democrat won.
Gotcha. And so that means if the Republicans write that into law now, it could possibly come back to haunt them at some point in the future.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dr. Ginn, I really appreciate you for having shared so many insights and tremendous insights with us regarding this process. And I definitely hope that we can get together again to talk more about the political process and particularly the role that we the people play in it.
That sounds wonderful.
Great. Thank you much. You all stay with me. I'll be right back.